Andrew Powell, I'm chairman of the organising Easter, though not the organising committee. I've sat here fascinated, and I think as an ex-PhD student that we've learnt tonight an awful lot, or we seem to be learning an awful lot about smaller and smaller things, just like you did when, or I did when I was a student. How do you think this explains the bigger picture of how the universe was formed? Are we moving any closer with our astronomical observations to understanding that big picture?
Well, I think that we certainly are. But in a way, that the business of the origin of the universe itself, the very early stages of the Big Bang and so on, are going to be addressed by Herschel's sister mission, Planck. So Herschel was launched at the top of the Ariane 5 spacecraft, and sitting underneath it was Planck, which is a smaller mission. And Planck is mapping the cosmic microwave background radiation, which peaks at a wavelength of around a millimeter. So about half of the radiation is microwave, and about half of it you could think of as sub-millimeter radiation. And by this radiation is the relic of the hot Big Bang, and it's very smooth, but what this satellite is doing is mapping small irregularities, and these tell us, they allow us to characterize what the universe is made of. And it's a little bit like a musical instrument. If you have a violin and you play it through an oscilloscope, you see a pattern of waves, and from these you can sort of work out what kind of instrument it is that you're looking at on the screen. So the point is that in the pattern of vibrations, which is what we're looking at, these vibrations embedded in the microwave background radiation, they kind of tell us what the universe is made of. So that's going on as we speak, and you'll hear results from the Planck mission next year. There have been previous missions like that have told us a great deal. They've told us that we've got to have dark matter, and we've got to have dark energy, and the universe is 13.7 billion years old. But Planck will tell us other things as well. So the very early stages of the universe come from Planck. But what Herschel tells us is the story of galaxy formation and evolution, star formation and evolution. So the whole story of the universe, not from the Big Bang itself, but from starting from a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, when lumps of stuff start to fall together and make stars, make galaxies. So that's the story that Herschel's mapping out. And we haven't perhaps covered very much of that today, but in a way we haven't really probably extracted all the results yet. So we're still working really on these various surveys. We've seen tens of thousands of galaxies being mapped with Herschel. So that's still being processed to try and get the picture of the history of star formation in the universe and how the stuff we're made of was formed in these at earlier times in the universe.
Okay, this is a question for Matt Griffin. About three quarters of the way through your talk, you showed us a spectrum in which superimposed on the black body line were spikes due to carbon monoxide and water. I just wondered what was the mechanism that gave rise to those signals from the molecules. In other words, is it vibrational?
It's actually rotational, vibrational transitions due to the atoms in a molecule vibrating back and forth on the end of the chemical bond, which acts like a very stiff spring, tend to produce quantum mechanical transitions that correspond to photons at infrared wavelengths of, say, a few microns. But as a molecule rotates, if it has a dipole moment, if it has a separation of charge, then it also has rotational quantum states. and it can undergo transitions between rotational levels, and those are at lower energies, and they correspond to photons at longer wavelengths. And it's the rotational transitions of water and carbon monoxide and various other molecules that Herschel can detect.
I'm wondering if you have come across gravitational lensing effect, and Herschel, I'm also wondering if Herschel data can be used to study strong lensing.
Well, yes. One of the really exciting discoveries from the Herschel galaxy surveys is that quite a proportion of these very luminous submillimeter galaxies are lensed. And so far there's been quite a number of strong-lensed galaxies discovered and studied, but we're still at the beginning. But I would say, roughly speaking, in the Herschel survey, something like 15% of the galaxies, certainly in the brighter ones, are actually lensed. So it's a big issue in these submillimeter surveys. So that's quite that is one of the exciting things that's coming out. Yes, absolutely. Good question. Yeah, go on. Yes.
This was actually one of the pleasant surprises for many people with the SPIRE instrument, although some people did predict it before launch, so we didn't listen to them carefully enough. In the few instances where we have strong lensing, where we have a large elliptical directly in the line of sight, we get an amplification factor of between 10 and 30, which allows us to do spectroscopy on the background galaxy by basically giving us an amplification of the signal. And that's allowed us to see further out into the universe with the spectrometers than we originally expected, and to do spectroscopy and detect spectral lines in galaxies that are at very high redshifts that formed on the order of 10 to 12 billion years ago. So we're using the lensing as a sort of a turbocharging effect in order to push further out and further back in time.
The life of this expensive Herschel telescope seems to be determined by the amount of helium that it can carry. Will your next expensive launch have an improved method of cooling?
That's a really good question. The limited lifetime of a cryogenic mission with a tank of liquid helium imposes a great deal of pressure on making sure that we make maximum use of every available observing day and observing minute. And the mission always ends before we're satisfied that we've done as much as we'd like with it. But the technology wasn't there to fly anything else when Herschel was being designed. The next mission that I mentioned, Spica, will use mechanical coolers in a complicated chain with additional coolers at the end, and it will basically have unlimited lifetime dictated only by the reliability of the mechanical compressors that are used in the refrigerator. And they will be specified for a minimum lifetime of 5 years, but if they're well made and if the whole observatory functions well, then they could last twice that at least. So we'd be looking at a typical decade-long lifetime rather than a lifetime of a few years, and that will be much better value for money.
Yeah. If I could add something as well, NASA's next mission in the infrared will be the James Webb Space Telescope, which is due for launch in 2018. And it's a successor to both Hubble and Spitzer. It'll be a 6.5-meter telescope, and it will have no cryogens on board. We rely on closed-cycle coolers and passive cooling of the telescope. And it's got a design lifetime of at least 10 years, but they hope to go much further than that. It will be determined by using up the attitude control jets.
Right, and it's worth adding that the Planck mission has got mechanical coolers on board, but it also has to carry some cryogen as well.
Excuse what I suspect might be a rather naive question, but Matt made reference to positioning Herschel at the L2 point. An exceptionally good point from which to make these observations. Is there any competition for space at it? How big is this point? How many observatories can you actually get up there? Will a time come when there is competition for space there between different missions?
Well, of course, as Matt said, Herschel doesn't actually sit at L2, it's orbiting around it, and Planck is as well, and there are some previous missions, junk, sitting there. But no, Spitzer's not at L2. No, it was WMAP. Was it L2? But the thing is that I think I'm right in saying that things that are in orbit at L2 don't stay there; they drift away. So once you stop consciously holding them there, they drift away from L2. So it's not a stable point. And of course, space is very big. So provided you don't go too close, you could probably keep using it for a while. I actually set an exam question about L2 a couple of years ago at Imperial. And one of the things I noted, which is quite interesting, I don't know whether you know this, but if you are at L2, the sun appears in annular eclipse. So there's a little homework for you to do to go away and check that.
Hiya. My question is actually kind of related to both of these. With regards to the cryogenics on board. You said that it's a greater advantage to be put out at L2 because you're away from the temperature of Earth and whatever. But surely there would be more of an advantage of putting it in a low Earth orbit so that you could send up astronauts or whatever in order to replace cryogenic coolants and things like that.
It would be an advantage in principle, but not for a cryogenic mission like Herschel, because if we had Herschel in low Earth orbit, or anywhere near the Earth, then the temperature attained by the outer cryostat vessel would be much higher, and that means the helium would boil off more quickly, so the lifetime would have been severely compromised. One might say that it's conceivable that you could have a capability to go up and refill the cryostat with astronauts, which would be great. We'd certainly take that, but ESA doesn't have a program that's capable of doing that. And if you look at the economics in a realistic way, a single launch of the shuttle, which you would need in order to refill the helium tank, costs about the same as the Herschel mission. So you might as well just fly another one, or fly another better one.
And I think it's worth adding that although when the shuttle was built, in the spec it said we're going to go up and get things and bring them back and so on. It's only done that for one instrument, and that's the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope has been a flagship of the whole astronaut program. And if you talk to the astronauts, they're terribly proud of the fact their role in the Hubble Space Telescope, because that's something that's really worth, for them, it's something that they feel they've done that's really worthwhile. But I think the problem with the shuttle, if you remember, was that towards the end of its life, it became clear that it's not really a safe spacecraft. It was too risky, really. I mean, it had two disasters, and in fact, it was not really safe enough for sending astronauts up and back. So it's a problem that you here have to solve in the future, really. How to do this thing better in the future.
Obviously, there's a workload for the telescope, so how is that managed? Do applications come in from universities and ESA? Yes,
essentially, ESA organises... Well, I don't know, Matt, you've probably been involved with this process. And
I haven't, actually, except that the people who build the instrument get a little bit of guaranteed time to compensate for the sustained anguish of building the instrument. But the rest of the time is for open competition, maybe where you can describe that.
Well, I haven't done it for Herschel, but I did it for the Infrared Space Observatory. So basically, the agency announces that the first year of time will be allocated. I mean, this is well before the period is going to be allocated. And so all the scientists in Europe write in their proposals, and then a committee meets and reads all these through and decides which ones to do. So it is a competition, and which is judged by a panel, a bit like the Booker Prize or the Nobel Prize or whatever. So it's done by peer review. And if you get time on a space mission like Herschel or ISO or the Hubble Space Telescope, I mean, it's a very valuable commodity when you're considering these
missions cost at least £500 million or dollars. A chunk of observation, extremely valuable. In America, if you get time on one of their missions, NASA gives you $20,000 or $100,000 or something to help you, support you while you're exploiting that data. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen in Europe. It jolly well ought to, but it doesn't. Right, I'm dying to put a question to you, actually. So we've heard about the idea of crashing Herschel into the moon, and I think we should have a poll on this. Okay, so I'm going to ask you whether you think Herschel should be crashed into the moon. One alternative is to leave it gradually getting further and further away from L2, quietly living out its life in dignity. I mean, I think you have to... Well, you can either think of it from the point of view of what's more dignified for Herschel, or you could think about whether it's polluting the moon, whether it's an appropriate thing to do to the moon. We're not going to have a debate about it. We're just going to have a vote. Okay. Right. Those in favour of crashing Herschel into the moon. Those against. Well, I'm afraid it's carried, so
thanks very much for having that in front of you.
I think we should...
I shall report these findings to ESA and tell them that they must take the views of the public into account.
It was a pretty massive vote by an expert audience, so...
Thank you. Des Prowse, Goonhilly New Ventures. Maybe an awkward question. I don't recall in your presentation who was the prime contractor for putting together the Herschel telescope. Could you advise on that, please?
The prime contractor for Herschel, and indeed its sister satellite Planck, they were implemented as a single project, and the prime contract was a French firm, now Thales Alenia, in Cannes. They were originally Aerospatiale, and they won the prime contract in competition with what used to be Dornier in Germany, but is basically now Astrium. Those are the two sort of big behemoths of the European space industry, and they sort of take it in turns to be prime on major ESA projects.
Sorry, could I just come, because I, as you know, I have to give the vote of thanks, and I was going to actually mention Astrium in that, and I by what you're saying, Thales Alenia is not part of Astrium, so actually Astrium wasn't responsible for putting together the Herschel telescope.
Well, Astrium was actually subcontracted. Astrium Germany were subcontracted to do the Herschel cryostat. Lots of other subsystems in the satellite were subcontracted all over Europe. So the prime contractor is really the organizing authority, but the job of building all the subsystems gets farmed out to all and sundry.
I think Astrium were the subcontractors on the Planck coolers.
Yeah, Astrium built the 4K cooler for the Planck instrument.
Yes.
Astrium UK.
Yeah. Astrium UK built the 4K coolers, but they were rather late.
They weren't the only ones who were.
They weren't the only ones. just in case you want to boast too much.
There was an announcement yesterday, which. I think the gist of it was that the Chancellor has found 120 million or some such to increase our contribution to ESA. Is this going to be seen as being advantageous to your community?
Well, strictly speaking, the space element of it, of his new money for science, for a number of different science projects, the space part was to host an ESA institute. So ESA has a number of different institutes and labs and so on scattered through the member states. And this was for money to host the ESA institute for small satellites, for communication satellites. Is that right? Have I got it right?
Yeah, it's basically telecommunications.
Telecommunications, yes. So it is hosting an ESA institute that is good for
the image of the UK, and so on. It isn't directly helping the space science program, but the fact that the government is actually supporting ESA in any way at all is good for us, really, because we have had previous governments that were extremely anti-ESA. It's well known that when Comet Halley, when the Giotto spacecraft flew a rendezvous to Comet Halley, and it was shown on television and everything, and Margaret Thatcher was watching it, the broadcasting process was done so poorly, that's to say the commentators on it and you know, description of what you were seeing was done so poorly, Margaret Thatcher was completely disgusted and withdrew support for space for some years after that. So anyway, we don't... I think that's the positive, really, that the government is not anti-space. It's not actually, at the moment, new money for space science, but, you know, maybe that will come too.
I just wanted to... Carl Warren from Astrium, I just wanted to comment on your comment there. Although there's not new money for space science, there is new money for other aspects of Earth observation, particularly for, we're hoping for the METOP second generation, which is the next generation of meteorological satellites, and also for the Earth observation program looking at the Earth environment. So I just wanted to make that sort of clear. It's about 25% uplift in the total program over the next few years. No, I'm speaking just as my personal read and take on the announcement. So it is new money, although it's not for space science specifically, but it's good news.
Roger Boddy of Global Teleports. I've been fascinated to hear what's been said, and it's been fabulous to sit here monitoring the stream we've been putting out over satellite. Can I just tell you that we've had some feedback from Rio de Janeiro? They think it's a fabulous talk too.
Wow. So where's the camera? The camera's up there, is it? Well, Rio de Janeiro, thank you very much, and keep watching. So everybody is happy, satisfied, understands everything. Right. I'll draw the evening to a close. We're going to have a vote of thanks in a second. I think I'm not going to try and summarise what we've heard this evening, but I did want to remind ourselves again of William Herschel. I mean, I think this evening is a fantastic tribute to William Herschel's fantastic discovery of infrared radiation, such a fundamental discovery that's certainly transformed astronomy. It took a long time for the full implication of it to come home, and infrared astronomy itself was not the first of the new astronomies. So radio astronomy came first, X-ray astronomy, and infrared is certainly the full panoply of infrared astronomy you've heard about tonight then followed. But it's William Herschel that we owe the all this to. And so it's very appropriate that it's the mission named after him that we've been hearing about, which has been such a success. And I think we've probably only heard a small fraction of the science that will eventually come out of the Herschel mission. I think another point to make of a very general kind is the huge number of people that are involved in an enterprise of this kind. Typically, a space mission involves about of order 1,000 scientists and engineers working together. And, of course, in talks like these, which tend to emphasize the scientific aspects, perhaps the engineers don't get as much credit as they deserve. If you actually work inside one of these missions, you have nothing but respect for the engineers who implement the whole thing and have such enormous expertise in the different fields that are needed to assemble something like this, test it, operate it, and so on.